The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Dr. Gregory Pinto, Bahamian urologist, and this is The Urologist Speaks. Good evening. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Wesley Francis, who is a Bahamian surgical oncologist and general surgeon. Good evening. Thank you for being here, Dr. Francis.
Good evening, Dr. Pinto, and good evening, Bahamas. Always a pleasure to be here.
So we're waiting momentarily for our guest of honor.
Surprise guest,
the esteemed Dr. Mark Weish.
You're not surprising him. Well, you just revealed it.
Yes, he's an intensivist and a senior anesthetist who's well-known throughout the country and very well-respected in the public domain and within the medical fraternity itself. So he has a lot of information that he can relay to all of us in regards to his stance in terms of what is going on in health, how can we change the trend, how can we improve things, what has he seen change throughout the years. We definitely want to talk about the public system, the private system. We're talking about insurances. We're going to talk about overwhelming non-communicable diseases in our society, overwhelming number of persons with obesity, hypertension, diabetes, the overwhelming cancer numbers. Obviously, we'll rely on our cancer expert, surgical oncologist, Dr. Wesley Francis. But we're also going to talk about a lot of things that are topical in terms of suicide rates, etc. So, Dr. Francis, you being in medicine now at least 25-plus years back in the Bahamas, what have you seen in terms of the trends, in terms of the delivery of healthcare, in terms of patients, in terms of disease processes, etc.? Have you seen an uptake? I know that you've mentioned in the past that in terms of breast cancers, you're seeing younger and younger numbers in terms of age, which is very disturbing. A lot of women being diagnosed not just with breast cancer, but with advanced breast cancer before the age of 40. As a surgical oncologist and, I guess, the resident cancer expert in the nation, what are you seeing in terms of the trends in terms of cancer that you deal with in the last 25 years?
I mean, thanks, Greg, for that. So I think we should probably focus on the non-communicable diseases. But I think what we're starting to see is a lot more, and we've talked about it on the show before, a lot more modifiable risk factors that lead to cancers, like obesity, smoking, alcohol use. All of these things can be modified. When you look at cancer trends over the last few years, and you look at the actual data out of our cancer registries, I mean, prior to 2018, we had numbers that were high, but those numbers only really represented what was in the public sector. But once the cancer registry came on, we started to actually see the real numbers. And they were still somewhat underestimated or understated, because there's still a lot of people seek care abroad. And so we still don't actually get those numbers back. And the cancer registry has, you know, been trying to get relationships with registries in the U.S., particularly Florida, because I think most Bahamians who seek care abroad would go to Florida, so that we could have actual, more accurate numbers. But the trends are always going up. I think during COVID, we started to see the trend go down a bit in the numbers. And the real reason for that is because during COVID, nobody was getting treated.
Or screened.
Starting to see that the numbers go up. And what are the cancers that are involved? Breast cancer, obviously, prostate cancer, as you know, and then colon. Those are the big three. And so, and certainly what we've been talking about too is the alarming increase in obesity within the within our country, and the downstream effects of that on our health system, and trauma also, and all of those have eroded our health system and made it overburdened. We're now joined by our esteemed colleague, Dr. Mark Weish, who, you know, I originally met Dr. Weish when I was an intern, and not to date myself, but it was 1998, and he was a consultant, and he was one of the young guns at the time. I mean, fresh. I remember when he first became he was in charge of the ICU. And when he became director of the ICU, I distinctly remember sitting in the audience, and I was an intern at the time. And I've worked closely with Dr. Weish over the years. And I would say Weish is one of the physicians, I would say, pays attention to detail. He's very detail-oriented. And he detail-oriented from a medical point of view, and also he's always into your family too. So he's going to ask you all about your grandparents, your great-great-grandparents, and one of the things that I like about Dr. Weish is that he brings to force the fundamentals of medicine, able to have that relationship with the patient where you ask them to detail their complaints. And he examines patients, even to this day, after 40 years plus. I see Weish examine patients on the internet. So, Dr. Weish, welcome to Urology Speaks.
Well, let me start with my two bits as well. I always mention there are too few role models in this society, and everybody needs a guiding light. Everybody needs someone to aspire to be like. Dr. Weish is that for me. I have a few mentors in my life, and I also met him over 25 years ago, and he was someone I championed and wanted to aspire to be, not just as a physician, but as I saw him as a Bain citizen, raised in Bimini and in Nassau. He's done a lot for the nation, I think. That culminated during COVID when our healthcare system was on its knees and he risked his life. And that's not an exaggeration, because before there was a vaccine and there were millions, I think in the end almost 2 million persons succumbing to COVID in the United States. And I think 800, 900 Bahamians actually succumbed to COVID, unfortunately and sadly, in our beautiful Bahamas. He was the one in the South Beach clinics risking his life, putting his life in peril, trying to save lives, and he did save many lives. And in fact, we can be proud as a nation and as a medical fraternity that we actually, in terms of per capita, did better during COVID-19 than many first world nations, including the United States. And a lot of that was due to the sacrifices of many persons, of nurses, persons on the front line, ambulance drivers, young physicians, senior physicians, and Dr. Weish is one of them. So, good words about yourself, more than that we've just...
Well, thank you for the invitation. It sounds like a bit of hyperbole to listen to all of that, but I don't think I've had any success at anything in my life without a team effort, to be honest. So on behalf of the teams of all the services you mentioned, ICU, PMH, and South Beach Clinic, great people, a great set of people at both stages of my career. And I too had mentors. I could think of some of them right now, like Ronnie Knowles, Glenn Benneby, Jeff Penniman, my own contemporaries like Reginald Nemore, Dwayne Sands, Paul Ramphal. I mean, the list goes on. I'm not going to name all of them, but... And then you too. I work with you all quite a bit. It's good to get the stimulation of the younger group. You all are very aggressive in what you all do, and I find it very challenging and stimulating, because that's what you need to maintain yourself. You have to always reinvent Pinto.
Yes, very much so. So no man is an island, and we're all here trying to fight the fight. We're here in this public forum trying to be proactive, not just reactionary in terms of medicine. We're trying to turn the tide that can be very depressing when we look at it. We're looking at the numbers and every category that's negative. The Bahamas is almost always in the top 10. And how are we going to change that? I mean, we can have the best surgery centers, operating theaters, the best ICUs, but if we don't start from young and combat childhood obesity, when we try to instill combat sedentary lifestyle amongst the youth, when we're going to try to instill proper nutrition and dietary advice when you're young, maybe then, before someone becomes a diabetic, because before someone becomes a pre-diabetic, before someone becomes obese, we can stop them going down that road. So we don't want to just be able to provide economically all the best medication for free. That's always going to be a burden on our nation. Let's not, for example, in terms of crime, let's not build the best jails, the best prisons, and everything else. Let's prevent these young men, unfortunately, for the most part, going down the road of crime and violence. Let's stop these people getting sick. So obviously, there's modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors, and there are many things that are modifiable. How can we turn the trend, even for childhood obesity, maybe one in four, particularly female children, are obese? How are we going to stop this trend from getting worse and worse?
Dancer, what I would say to you is your weight or obesity is what you eat. Okay?
Or drink. Or don't exactly. Do in terms of not exercising.
Right. Yes. Yeah, exercising is important, but exercising makes you fit in general. And I'm not just talking about childhood obesity, but even into adulthood. It's really what we put into our tummies that make the difference. And I think the way to do it has to be a combination of government action and private enterprise. And then the PR associated with that. So we have to make healthier foods kind of like, I don't know what the term young people use now, that it equilibrates as hip, but we need to make those things hip. We need to make those things more affordable for families. We need to make highly processed foods, which tend to be high caloric, high salt, and fatty, less attractive. And as a nation that imports pretty much 90%+ of what we eat, this may be where the customs duties and the use of VAT, and certainly customs duties, may play a role. So you could find a way to, maybe from a government perspective, partnering with the private sector, importing things and encouraging to grow things locally that are going to be more nutritious for kids and adults. And then you need activities. You know, there's no real reason to reinvent the wheel. A lot of these things are now where you look at the Northern Europeans who bike to work. We need to probably inculcate a national change in what we... When I was a child, we cycled everywhere. We walked everywhere. I walked to school miles. Or I biked to school. Now we put our kids in a car and we drive them to school and we create traffic jams. So I think it has to be a concerted effort. And maybe the reason why I'm bringing government in is because you have to incentivize the private sector to do these things. They don't just happen willy-nilly. Things happen because of taxation rules, customs rules, which is another taxation, and which you emphasize.
Well, our small nation is definitely at a crossroads, and we have to act. We have to act as a nation. Our health of the nation is the wealth of the nation. However, health will not matter much if corruption and crime and violence destroy our beautiful Bahamas. So we need to act on all levels. So it's not just the physical that we have to look at. We have to look at the spiritual. We have to look at the social. There's a lot of social ill health. There's a lot of hopelessness. You can ask somebody to eat right, to exercise, And they're going to say, I'm working two jobs. I don't even see a future. I'm living not just month to month, but week to week. I come home exhausted. If I can stop off at a fast food joint and get some food, that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to worry about trying to spend the time to go to the grocery store, prepare a healthy meal, et cetera, et cetera. So we need to take the stress off the regular citizen. They're fighting just to get by, try to pay their rent, trying to pay for school fees, put clothes on their children's back. Unfortunately, we have a very stressed nation because we're primarily a matriarchal society where the vast majority of children are raised by single. In the 60s, in our Bahamas, maybe 70% of children were born within wedlock. Now the opposite, about 80%. So it's almost a given. The vast majority of children in this society, unfortunately, are being raised in a single-family home. In many of the cases, it's one mother, four children, five children, possibly a grandmother. Because of the economics, because we're one of the 10 most expensive countries in the world to live in, how can anyone succeed? It's just going to be a vicious cycle. Instead of one generation being better than the next, it's actually going downward.
So we have Dr. Weishaer, right? And I mean, we've already kind of gave his resume out there and say, you know, how he's an expert in health-related issues. Certainly one of the best clinicians that I know. And Weish has been in the system for over 30 years, because I know he is now retired from the public sector. And he didn't retire early, so it was somewhat... In your experience, over the last, let's say, 30 years, how have you seen changes in our health system and how it serves our community, given all these social ills and issues that we have? Do you believe that our health system has evolved to meet the challenges that we now face with all that Pinto has just said?
I guess I'll answer that specifically, but one thing I want to say, and you both have intimated it, which is health and wealth go together.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't exist in a vacuum. So incentivizing certain things and trying to make it affordable makes health easier. I would say, I don't want to bash or lambaste the public health care system, because I think there have been some things that have been very good and some things that have not been so good. But the overall picture that I have is we get these spurts and starts, and then we stagnate or we plateau for different reasons, some of which, by the way, is, and I'm going to blame the politicians for this, because we have no bipartisanship in this country with regards to continuing administrative efforts. So if I start a program, let's say I start national health care providing primary care, one would think that it should be shared between the political parties, so when the next administration comes in, yes, they may put their spin on it, but the skeleton or the outline of the project can move forward, not change these people and change the ideas, put my people in there to move it again. And that's part of the problem, I think. But there have been some noticeable successes. I mean, from a practical standpoint, and I was talking to someone about this the other day, when I was an intern, the pediatric ward was the most overcrowded ward in Princess Margaret Hospital.
Indeed.
And there was a major move, and I mean, someone like Dr. McNeil et al. Would need to speak about this, but there was a major move to put the doctors in pediatrics out into community, along with other incentives through public health and social services, et cetera, to deal with these children before they became ill. Some of that was social services, as I mentioned. Some of that was vaccination. But a lot of it had to do with bringing the professionals together as a group in a clinic outside of PMH. So therefore, the admission rate slowed. If we had mimicked that with adult medicine, for example, I think we would see less admissions. I think we would see less heart disease, less kidney disease, less all those other things. But that does not work in a vacuum, because it's easy to do that with children because they have very specific diseases, usually communicable. Nowadays, more non-communicable, but we've seen obesity and hypertension and all these other things. But certainly 20, 30 years ago, it was more communicable social services issues. But the point is we got together as a group of professionals, and let's remember now, physicians and nurses aren't the only health professionals. We have a whole cadre of health professionals and peri-health professionals and social services that can make it work. So I think various administrations, various ministers of health have had very good visions. The problem that I've seen is when the next team comes in, they do something else. And you don't always get a continuation of what is good. And I also think we need to use our resources through the Commonwealth. We've gotten good ideas out of New Zealand and Australia and India and whatever else. We've had drug partnerships. We've learned about that. We've spoken to people in Singapore. We need to use our resources a lot better, and we need more bipartisanship. And I think that's the issue. So there have been some positives. We got a new critical care buck, which has its own challenges now. But you see where some administrations come in and they do something. Yeah. Other administrations may or may not build on it. And I think that's what we need to fix.
I think, well, you spoke about the critical care block. We all thought in medicine that was going to change a lot of things. It unfortunately hasn't. Maybe initially when you had six brand new operating theaters, you had a minor operating theater, endoscopic theater, et cetera. But then we had all this brand new equipment. Everything was great for a couple of years. But you have to have the foresight to know that you have to have warranties on all these equipment. You need to have servicing for all these equipment. So even within urology, for example, a cystoscope or a ureteroscope, or we're very heavily reliant on equipment in urology. A ureteroscope, which you use to go through the urethra, up the bladder, into the ureter, into the kidney itself. It's either diagnostic or therapeutic in terms of lasering stones, etc. It has many uses. The typical scope, it's a fiber optic scope, only has be for 70 uses. And beyond 70 uses, you have to have it serviced, or you got to have it repaired, or you got to have it replaced. And unfortunately, there were a lot of things that were purchased, and there were no service agreements in place, and they just lay dormant. And it was a complete waste of money. All of a sudden that we couldn't do any lasering of stones for years. We couldn't resect any prostates for years. And it goes beyond that. In terms of staffing, we had the beautiful theaters that can rival any theaters in the world in terms of the way it looked, the aesthetics, but we didn't have the anesthesia staff to run six theaters at any one time. We didn't have the nursing staff to run the theaters at any one time. And just from urology perspective, along with many other surgical specialties, we are only allowed to operate once every 2 weeks. You cannot function in a public health system when you only can operate, and that's because of staffing issues. So there's a lot of issues with brain drain as well.
Challenges,
Nursing, we have the best and brightest nurses leaving for greener pastures. You can't blame them, but that's also an issue. We have a lot of brilliant specialists, behemoth specialists, who never came back, and there are many reasons for that. I'll look within my own family. We can probably, if I look at all the persons abroad in my family who are super specialized in this part of medicine and other, we could probably open our own hospital, but it's not a very welcome environment. We can all talk about the stories of that, but I think what we need to do is welcome our own, and if somebody specializes, have a pathway for them to come back, make changes, and feel that they're accomplishing something. For example, I was a consultant urologist with a fellowship in Germany at one of the top academic institutions that's well known throughout Europe, well respected. I was teaching other urologists, etc., and had my own operating theater list and everything else. And then I came back to the Princess Margaret Hospital, where I'm an SHO because I was SHO on paper. And I stayed an SHO on paper for 5 years. So that can break your heart. Yeah. And then when we talk about you're not going to get your back pay, you're not going to get your pay increase, it's not fair to ask a behemoth to come back when they've put in the time, they've made the sacrifices, they can go anywhere in the world.
We still got to build, though. You know, we got to build. And I think... and. I'm happy that we have We Share, and we try to go back to that, right?
Because let me just ask one question. Yeah. How long did it take you to be promoted to a consultant on paper? It took me 5 years.
You know, but I functioned as a consultant from day one. it didn't matter the promotion to me, right? But I functioned that way, and I provided the expertise that I learned. And I think that's what it is. Wherever you go and you come back, right, you bring those expertise with you. And I believe that that's when healthcare changes in this country, right? Because all of the bright, all of the intelligent, students that we have that go off, and that's why we have to encourage them to come back, because that's when you have the major shift or major change, right? So in Risha's generation, you had a group of guys who came back, and they were pioneers. And then there was a generation that followed him, and he talks about how he works with us and how we push the envelope. Will you tell us a little bit about that? What are you seeing in terms of from your generation to the evolution? And I wanted to really kind of focus on the evolution of the health services that we have based on the kind of expertise or specialists that we have, because we're becoming a highly technical and more specialized set of folks trying to deal with the sometimes social issues that we have now. What have you seen in your 30 plus years as that has evolved? I think I want to get that from you.
Yeah. What has just come into my mind is, and I'm trying to remember the name of the author, a brilliant author from 100 years ago that described how Henry Ford was the death of the generalists, so to speak.
Right.
He opined about no one man can make a pin anymore, because in Henry Ford's world, eyes on someone assembled the engine, someone did this. In many respects, that's what has happened to us. One of the things one of my colleagues, Dr. Penniman, always used to say, and it probably still is true for what we are in this small country, is you have to be a generalist and a specialist. We don't have that much room for people who only want to do their specialty. I mean, the numbers can't support it.
Right.
And listen, the big change I've seen in my three decades being a physician at a consultant level and longer than that at a junior level is the attitude of the professional. So mm-hmm. when I went to medical school, and I say this all the time, I went to medical school and I paid $2,500 a year. And I'm sure it was $25,000. It was 10 times that amount. The government paid for me to go to medical school.
Same here.
So I felt that I had an obligation to pay back. But then, also I grew up in the 70s. So when I grew up, we were emerging as a nation, and people were inculcated with this. It wasn't a nationalist inculcation. It was like, hey, you now have this opportunity. You have a chance to build. And I felt that as a young person. I don't know if we're able to do that now, but that's one of the things I think we need to do. We need to find some way to make the young people, and you say young men are lost. You both have sons. I haven't raised any sons. I've raised daughters, or my wife would say she raised daughters. It's a separate issue. But we need to inculcate some sort of pride, self-esteem, and goal orientation in our young people, and that will translate into the professionals. I find now we don't have the same idea of, okay, I will provide a certain amount to the public service, and I will bring my private practice into it to raise the standards. And of course, you get more people, if the pie doesn't increase, you're sharing more of the pie. But it all comes down to health financing, I must be honest with you. So to answer your question specifically, I think, and then the other thing to go back, though, is you have to function as a group. One of the big things about J.P. Morgan, and when J.P. Morgan died, Rockefeller was surprised that he was only worth what he worth because he had so much power. So Rockefeller at the time was worth $1 billion, and J.P. Morgan was, I think, something like $150 million, which is 15% of Rockefeller. But he carried more weight than Rockefeller because he functioned as a leader of a pack of similar $150 million people. So you do better as a group. You better do better as a team. That shows up in a lot of studies. We talk about that all the time. When you want to do, especially very sophisticated work, if you work in with the same healthcare
absolutely,
team,
absolutely.
You get better results. So I think we have to inculcate teams. We have to inculcate groups. Even OBGYNs work better when you have more than one OBGYN in the group. Someone gets tired and sleepy, the other person takes over. So we have to inculcate that as a nation. We have to inculcate that in our professional realms. But at the end of the day, too, it's hard to do that with the way we do healthcare financing. So I'm going to turn the tables a little bit toward you, Westy, because you're the MBA amongst us. It would be interesting if you could speak to what you think we need to do from a healthcare financing perspective to get private physicians, private healthcare institutions, other private institutions who are willing to invest for their labor force in order to help the public service and in order to guide the public service with whatever they want to do for national health insurance so it could be viable. Because if it's not viable, it's going to die. I mean, the Brits are now fighting, and in fact, every election year they fight to save their national health insurance scheme. It's very expensive. If people are not going to contribute, and that the people, meaning the population, as well as the healthcare workers, as well as the hospital systems, and contribute also the way they look after themselves, the way they eat, the way they drink, and the way they exercise, it becomes a very expensive proposition. So I swing that question back to you because I think at the end of the day, that's the foundation.
But you know, I believe
we're,
that you
coming up to a break. We're
coming to a break?
We'll talk about the other break. End.
Okay. Yeah.
Reliable and impactful printing services, look no further. Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life. We stand by our quality products that is second to none. Our affordable pricing and friendly, efficient staff makes Printmasters the ultimate choice for all your printing needs. We can deliver any type of printing services, from banners to booklets to business cards. You name it, we can print it.
Let Printmasters bring your masterpiece to life.
Located in the Nassau Guardian Building, telephone 302-2361.
Girl, Junior just showed me Bulla Boy in his phone.
What you mean? He take picture of that good-for-nothing boy?
Shh, you don't want Bulla hair. You say that. You know she always say that's my good child.
So what he doing in Junior phone?
Oh, he there because the police looking for him. He on that wanted list.
Wanted persons in your phone now?
Yes, child. And when police want find anybody quick, after something happened, they can send picture direct to your phone. Go to Google Play or App Store and search for Crack Crime Bahamas, then pick install and it will go straight to your phone.
There is also a section on missing persons.
Yes, girl. Everybody needs to get this app so police can tell us right away when these people go missing. Just like an alert system.
Yes, it has numbers for Crime Stoppers Bahamas so you can call and nobody knows you. Call directly to Miami and give the information without giving your name or anything about you. I tried it the other day and when I hear Junior and his boys talking about where they hide those guns, I walk quick round the corner and call that number.
Call 328-8477 from Nassau or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
Always on the go? Missed the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Urologist Peace with Damien Urologist, Dr. Gregory Pinto. We're honored to have Dr. Westy Francis back as our co-host, who's a surgical oncologist and general surgeon. And we have the esteemed senior anesthetist and internist, intensivist, Dr. Mark Weish from Bimini.
He feels like an internist sometimes.
Yes,
though.
Well.
Very much so.
Yes, very much so. He knows as much as any internist. So we're talking about his knowledge in terms of the history of our nation in terms of medicine, the way forward, what does he see needs to change in terms of negative things that are happening. I just have one quick question. I know when you were intern at SHO, you just came back, probably the murder rate was 15 murders a year. Now, we're lucky to see 120, 130. How has violence, how has crime, how has gang-ridden society affected our public health system, just from you as an anesthetist, on call all the time with emergencies, interrupting elective lists? What is the burden of crime and violence been throughout the last three decades on our medical healthcare system?
I remember back in the late 90s, there was a shooting. I don't remember the name of the street. There's a pretty famous street on Nassau Street between where Dirties is. I don't know if I could call it Dirties on the radio.
That's a dirty
street. Yeah. And Bamboo Shack along that Eastern Corridor. The name of the street escapes me, but a lot of young kids were injured in that catastrophe. That was such a big thing. I mean, I don't remember how many. Dwayne may remember the details of that, but there are about five or six young people that came in with injuries, and it totally disrupted our system. It was such an unusual event that it was really, I mean, it jolted us. It was just so unusual. Now, three, four, five guys come in with a gunshot wound is a standard thing. I mean, I'll be honest with you.
That's a typical Monday.
Very much so. Weekend, you see them on Monday because they come in all from Friday night into Sunday night. But I had a young man come in one time and he was stabbed and his friend was shot. And I said, well, that's interesting. So he said to me, Doc, your sweetheart stabs you, but your rival shoots you. The difference with that, of course, is dealing with a knife wound is much easier than dealing with a gunshot wound, especially these automatic guns that can put 30 shots in a guy and paralyze people. It's just terrible. I mean, now we have sometimes a bed in ICU is occupied with someone with either major hip or spinal injury. Yeah. It's horrific. I don't know what to say. It's not just in the Bahamas, as you know, but in a small country where we have a very limited amount of resources in both the operating rooms and the critical care areas, it's a big thing.
So I'd like to spin that a little bit, right? Because I would say to you that out of all of that, we really developed a surgical residency program where a lot of our now consultant surgeons would have really learned how to operate because of that burden of trauma that we had. And I remember when I first came back home, one of the things that the group of us surgeons, we prided ourselves on is we watched those numbers, that murder rate number. And if anybody came in, we always prided ourselves in keeping that person alive to keep that number down. And so I think without the evolution of the health system, that number would be far higher. Because I think the burden of trauma overall is much higher than people, than is reflected by the murder rate, right?
And it's overwhelming. As a urologist in the public system, I saw so many young persons who are paraplegic from gunshot to the spine. And I remember one case, there's a patient who was paraplegic, developed intra-abdominal sepsis, was in ICU for 3 months, in and out of operating theater maybe 10, 12 times. And there was an estimation of the cost for that one patient who unfortunately eventually did succumb to all of his injuries. And it was over $640,000 for that one person. So one person went and shot somebody, caused all of that, and we wanted to know why the government doesn't have any money and why we can't buy this equipment or we can't provide this type of screening. That's just one individual. We have these individuals over and over and over, and the cost is in the tens of millions of dollars because of anger, because of unresolved issues, childhood trauma. Violence is too common in this society.
But you know, Yes, and we cannot dispute that. But I also want to focus on the positive. We have a call.
We have a call. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yeah, good afternoon, Doctor. How are you all doing?
We're doing fine. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just here listening to your show. It's kind of scary as for me as a Bahamian, you know, when you look at what's happening at PMH, and particularly PMH. And you see, you know, and I have this fear of going there without coming out at all. But it's the general sentiment of the average Bahamian, especially the ones who don't have health insurance. But what I'm seeing up there, dog, is kind of scary when you look at persons laying out on journeys who can't get the proper health care because of the overcrowding or the bed shortage, so to speak, right? But does the government liaison with the public hospital authorities or doctors? You see, because I'm one who kind of understand how countries are built when you're talking about population size. Many politicians believe that the Bahamas is underpopulated. I don't know where they get that theory from, but, and they're not, they don't have any data to back it up. But what they do, they've been regularizing persons and giving out these citizenships like candy. But I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe before you issue a work permit, before you issue a permanent residency or citizenship, it should be a collaborative type of conversation with the public health, the Ministry of Education, and you also have other sectors. For example, you have a lot of persons, you have overcrowding at PMH, you have overcrowding at our schools. If you don't go there quickly, you find your child, even though you may be living next door to a school, your child may have to go to a school way out of their jurisdiction because of the shortage of classroom space. But shouldn't, does the government communicate with you healthcare professionals before they issue all these things?
They're very good points. I'll even talk about colleagues of mine who have been in medicine 25, 30 years and have contributed more than almost any Bahamian I know, and they're not getting residency, and I know some persons who have no job, not contributing anything to the society, and not only got residency, but got citizenship. So it's a very unfair system.
But I wouldn't call it, I mean, you can call it unfair because in your capacity, but I can call it corrupt. That's basically what it is.
Well, I did mention at the onset of the corruption and crime and violence is destroying our country, and it is a shame. It is a shame.
What for me, this silent approach that is coming from the healthcare professionals, the education professionals, is mind-boggling to me. We hear the government now; they're taking steps to build a new home girl, as if there are no males in the society. Imagine that, women and girls. But we don't know how many persons are in the Bahamas. We definitely don't know. We don't know how much additional bed space we need, whereas the ratio will be comparative to the population size. But they're building this for $290 million hospital for women and girls. What could happen to the males? What happened to the... How does this work? Help me to make that make sense.
Well, I think...
In terms of what they're doing.
I understand you being frightened, but imagine as Dr. Francis and I, 20-something years ago, were senior house officers in obstetrics and gynecology. We never went into that as specialty. And we would see 60-70% of the children born at PMH being born to persons here illegally. And, I mean, that trend is gotten worse. So, yes, we have an overwhelming immigration problem. It's overwhelming our healthcare system. It's overwhelming our education.
You said that we don't have no crisis. You have been having, I said that maybe the entire cabinet should walk through PMH and walk in these overcrowded classrooms there, and they would maybe be able to appreciate the crisis. But do we have a crisis?
I mean, everybody in the Bahamas knows there is one, yes. But let Dr. Weish...
what you Carla, you've perfectly described the so-called boiling frog syndrome, where if you put a frog in a pot of lukewarm water and gradually heat it up, he won't move until he's boiled to death. But if you put him in cold water, he'll jump out. I mean, hot water, he'll jump out. So I think we've had a crisis with immigration and corruption and just pure laziness in our cell that you don't even see the nonsense because it's so high up. You can't see the forest for the trees of corruption and problems and crises that we have. So from my perspective, I'm not going to get political and talk about the proposed new hospital. I think the economics of that, if you look into it, and the statistics around that speaks to maybe not doing it, but I'm not going to get into that. What I would say from my perspective, I found that if you had dedicated people doing their job, you would have less of this. So from the healthcare perspective, if you're going to be a leader in the healthcare, if you're going to be a leader at the PHA in the Princess Margaret Hospital and Rand Memorial Hospital, and you're going to take on a job to be a chief of something, then you should be the chief of the department. You shouldn't be taking the name, the glory, the little extra pay, and then doing your private practice. If you're going to accept a role in the diplomatic corps or in social services or in customs or in immigration, you should do your job. I, for the life of me, cannot understand how we have this illegal immigration problem, because it's not the illegal immigrants themselves. They come because that is what human beings do. And I respect them for that. Any person who will get on a boat in the middle of January with 20-foot seas and want to come and work here, that's probably a good worker. But that's not the point. The point is if you have a business and you need a good worker, you should bring them in legally. And I don't see how we turn a blind eye to the people who risk the lives of these people on the high seas, take advantage of them, put them in sexual and economic slavery, and we benefit. Bahamians do that. We do that. We accept roles as leaders for namesake only, and we do not do our job. And that's the problem. If you're going to accept a role, you should do it. If you're not able to do it, you should decline. That's my two cents on that.
That's powerful.
That's to an extent, but I'll say this in conclusion. I'll say this, right? We are one of the most backward countries in the world and the most ad hoc. Imagine 2025. And we have leaders who are managing this country from their head. We don't have a national development plan. You go in Canada, you go to the UK, you go to China, you look around, they have a visionary national development plan. If I want to build a wall, I need a permit. If I want to build a two-room house, I need a plan. But what else do we expect to happen when we have persons managing the country from their head?
You know, I'm going to support what you're saying. I was in Singapore a couple of months ago, and we met with someone who said something so profound to me, and I've been repeating it to just about everyone who I have a chance to, so I'm going to say it here. In Singapore, they have a department. In fact, they have a department that links with the Economic Development Department, and they project 40 to 50 years in the future. Now, I know and I guess that's why I'm pushing by about to say, we don't even have five-year plans, like you're saying. These guys have 50-year plans about where they should go and what are the alternatives, what are the exigencies, and how we can get there. So I concur. I concur with what you said.
We have 39 members of parliament. We have just over 400,000 people. I mean, if you include the illegal immigrants and all the other immigrants, I think we should be around a million. But and the reality is, you got to blame you people who are part of the intelligentsia community. You all have to share some of the blame too, because no way, there's nothing no government can do to you guys who are educated. I trained my daughter and I told her, I said, you're not going to make no minimum wage, not under my watch. And she was able to graduate at 22 degrees. That's how you, if you have degrees, you're educated. Why are you all afraid of the government? You all are not standing up to the government and say, hey, you want to create a big bottleneck situation here in my profession. You want to come down. When you go into PMH, people laying out on gurney, when they die, families are discovering that these people are bad souls. These things would I experienced personally. I mean, we're out of control.
Maybe what we should, when we have our strikes, we should strike for betterment for the patients rather than just for ourselves. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Thank you.
It's just a scary situation for the average Bahamian, because you don't want to end up in PMH, because you know you're going to die.
You know,
you're going to die, yeah. And you're going to die from neglect. And I had a friend in there, and I watched the gentleman. He was in pain, and I was just sitting there watching. We were talking. I said, look, the gentleman in pain. Certain nurses were saying to me, oh, he's under doctor's care. Where's the doctor? Probably, just like you say, in their own private practice. And nobody touches that patient because he's under doctor's care. What type of system is that?
Yeah, it's a very unfair system. For example, as a urologist, we had no registrar in urology. So first call came to myself and Dr. Stevens, who was the other consultant. So we were on call half of our life, 24/7. Anything in our life that we were doing, we'd have to drop and run. Completely unfair. Nobody at our senior levels should have to work and do that grunt work. If someone has a catheter problem, 3 o'clock in the morning, I got to run out and deal with it. And it's just frustrating beyond words. I can speak for 10 hours on that.
That patient would love that, right?
Yes.
Because that patient getting treated by the
very
person, right?
Very much so. But
so, you know, we...
Venting, you know, and throwing tantrums for you, but the reality is, man, I mean, if you don't laugh at the situation, you'll cry, right?
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, man, we're in trouble, and we need to hear the healthcare professionals saying it. We need to hear the educational professionals saying it.
Well, I'll also counter and I'll say, as I said earlier, we did, as a healthcare system, we did better overall with COVID-19 than United States per capita. That's saying something. I've seen, I've been all around the world operating. I've seen some trauma cases that probably wouldn't have survived if they were in the top hospital in California or Florida or Atlanta. But because we have such trauma experience and we have such expertise, because we see it so much, we have had peace. The murder rate would be a lot higher if we didn't have such excellent surgeons at PMH.
It would. And the thing about it, right? I mean, we talk about PMH, and I would say that the good things that happen at PMH never gets out.
Very much so.
Okay?
Yes.
PMH is a safety net hospital. I mean, there are different things you can call the different categories of hospital, but it's a safety net hospital. And I'm troubled to hear this caller, and I've seen the trend over the years, and Rish hasn't touched on it, but you know, every out there should have a place where they can go if they're in trouble, and have some confidence in that system that it would be able to help them, right? And when I hear people say that, you know, they're afraid to go to PMH, what happens that is that their disease progress at home, because if they and you know, we touched on healthcare finance. If they're not insured, they can't go to doctor's hospital or to a private institution because of finances. Then the next place they have to go to is the safety net hospital, and that's the role that PMH plays in this country. But now if people don't want to go to the place of safety or the safety net, then we are in trouble. Because what happens, and this is what we end up seeing, people stay home, right? Because they have no confidence in the system. And then what happens is their disease just progresses. And then they turn up, and then it's too late.
Okay, good evening. We have another call. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yes, good evening. Dr. Pinto, of course. I remember Dr. Reish's name.
Dr. Francis.
Dr. Reish.
Hey.
You have a doctor who's beyond you regular. I forget it. What's his name now?
Dr. Wesley Francis.
Yeah, Dr. Wesley Francis.
This guy never remembers this week.
I'd like to say, Dr. Reish.
Yep.
Hello?
Yep.
I didn't notice Dr. Pinder said you were from Bimini, right?
That's true.
So that means that Marvin Reish, who went to SJ Sports, because Bimini's pretty smart.
He's a cousin.
Oh, all right, yeah. Well, I remember him. He was much older than me. He was like a big brother to me. He's his family to some of the Shermans.
Correct.
I've been there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess great. You know, I mean, listen, I just wanted to chime in as it relates to the PMH. But, you know, Cleveland made some interesting remarks and we need data, right? But I glad you, the doctor, was able to be fought with what he's seeing. There was also a health professional that called the other day. I think it was a nurse. And she had mentioned the problems with the language barrier, et cetera, et cetera, and the numerology, you know. And so I like how I was Dr. Wish, Dr.
Francis,
right? Said that one patient, as a result of a gunshot wound, was 600 some, which is ridiculous. And so it's going to continue. So I just am so, I'm not afraid to go into Princess Margaret or Dr. Pinto, no, because I'm armed with just a little bit of teeny-weeny knowledge with my teeny-weeny brains, right? I'm armed with that. So I feel confident. You know, I'll have a conversation with the doctor and I'll ask questions. That's just the way I feel. So, but as it relates to the surrounding areas and the pathogenicity of the hospital, I'm afraid. I normally try to be, I pay attention to details and I try to be, pay attention to my environment. Like, I look up a transmission dynamics in the hospital because I know what it's like under the basement area and all these different areas. And so, and even in first world places, you know, you can have diseases that transmit. And this is one of the reasons why when AIDS was first chemo, they asked the healthcare workers to be tested because it obviously they could just stick with needles, et cetera, et cetera. And the dentist, remember some of those things that the dentist transmitted the disease, et cetera, et cetera. So we was in an age of ignorance then. And so as it relates to the medical, the tech, when the conversation last with Dr. Pinto, he said that the LAS machine is still not at the hospital. So that means they would still be doing the TURP, which in itself is invasive and very bloody. And so the fact that the infrastructure is not being improved, the patients spend more time in the hospital. I was having gross hematuria post-surgery for years. I don't know if it's because of the the vascular regrowth. I've been reading up on my conditions a lot, but as it relates to cancer, right, and immune exhaustion, et cetera, T-cell exhaustion, right, and our holistic approach, they call it integrative medicine, as we look at cancer and chemotherapy and radiation. I know the difference. And in itself, the question is for me, doctor, two questions I would just like to say before I hang up. I'm very vexed at the healthcare system for not, the CAT scan is pretty effective, but I'm very vexed at the MRI. They're making a look at the MRI costs $1 billion. And so you was talking about cost. But there is a way. Where there's a will, there's a way. You know, even if people, I don't think people should just be walking into the hospital, legal or not, getting away with free medical care. There should be something that you should be made to pay, whether it be now or later. If they're going to take advantage of it, it shouldn't, and this is a burden on people who are able to afford that the government, it's just ridiculous. It just can't go on like that. So the MRI machine not being there, given the fact that MRIs can be fed algorithms and be able to diagnose those diseases before they come in the track. So that's a way of preventing, like catastrophic fallout as far as the body. And then something is a chain of thought here as it relates to the, I can't remember, it may be chemotherapy that itself, which is, it circulates chemicals in the body to kill cancer cells. And then I was familiarizing myself with neutropenia, right? Which will mean the neutrophils, which is the periphery. It really is a white blood cell that is really dominant in the blood system. They become low. And so is that true? Are you witnessing? Because if it actually does that, then is it weakening the immune system, which is counterproductive versus other forms of treatment for cancer? How effective is it? Its efficacy rate, side effects? Doctors are not fought with these kind of information in this age of alternative medicine. And the fallout with radiation and chemotherapy.
Yeah, you made some wonderful points.
I know the history of radiation.
Okay.
And it was used by the army, and it was used in mice and rats, and they need to be sincere about it. Give thanks.
Well, radiation in itself has grown by leaps and bounds in terms of image-guided radiation. Maybe 40 years ago, you had a radiation for your prostate. You just radiate the entire pelvis. You would have consequences in terms of post-radiation changes to your rectum, to your bladder, increase your risk of getting a secondary malignancy. So a lot has changed over the years. Chemotherapy has become very, very specific in terms of for the disease itself. But, for example, breast cancer has many diseases within itself. So immunotherapy is groundbreaking. We've spoken about that many times. But you need to walk a mile in a man's shoes or a woman's shoes before you can really criticize them. Yeah. And when we look at the nurses, they get the brunt of it when persons are frustrated, when they're angry, when they're afraid, and they come into the emergency room and they're not even enough trolleys to accommodate the patients, or even as a surgeon, we can't operate because we don't have a trolley to go and collect the patient from the ward to operate on, because there are 45 trolleys in the emergency room with patients waiting for a bed that doesn't exist. We have to also look at the public. You can't just blame the medical professionals. You can't just blame the government. You can't. The government isn't going around shooting people. The government isn't going around driving or drunk and recklessly and killing bystanders. The government is not going and robbing people in the middle of the night. So you have to also look at the violence and the crime and everything else. We have to look at what we're doing as a nation in terms of our morality, our integrity, our belief in ourselves. Why are you going out and having five children with five men and expect our nation to get any better? That might be controversial, but that's a fact. That's a fact.
I'd like to... I don't know how much time we have.
We should close out, right?
Yeah. What I wanted to say is Wesley brought up a very important point, and so that both callers, but especially the first caller, and that gets back into healthcare financing and how we advance from administration. PMH is that place that you should be able to come to when you're in a dire emergency. But what we should be doing is, like the pediatric patients, looking after these people on the outside before they need to come to PMH. Now, trauma is obviously different, some of the other things, but most of the things that impact the people lying on trolleys in the emergency department are chronic, non-communicable diseases. And we need to strengthen what we do on the outside. And we need to have compassion with those of us who work on the inside. And that necessitates governments working from administration to administration to fully develop what we need.
Well, I'd like to thank Dr. Weish for being here, and of course my co-host Dr. Wesley Francis, as always. I'd have to say this is part one.
We can eat a part two with Weish.
Dr. Wesley Francis has said it before I could say it. Yes. Dr. Weish, I hope you're available next week. We need a part two, because I know you have a lot more to say.
Business.
Yes.
Okay.
But my closing words would be to say that for the nation, wake up every single day thinking about how can I change my life for the better? How can I improve the life of my family? How can I improve the life and the world around me? We have a beautiful country. Let's not spoil it. Good evening and see you next week.
Take full control of your bladder. Don't let it control you.